From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at the week in Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
executions are halted, prompting a fierce back and forth between the state, judge, and death row attorneys.
Arkansas begins its search for a new head of the Department of Human Services, while the governor launches a campaign to fight obesity.
The Libertarian Party of Arkansas initiates a federal lawsuit over the state's filing deadline, and we'll look at a couple of candidates that are launching their own campaigns.
And the state backtracks on announcing student proficiency scores. We'll have the latest.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
For the week ending Friday, October 16th, this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Well, after we taped last week's podcast, big news came out. Pulaski County Circuit Judge Wendell Griffin issued an order halting 8 executions that are set to take place over the next 4 months. The first was to be a double execution next Wednesday. That prompted a flurry of activity throughout the week. On Monday, he ordered the state to release details about the drugs that are used in the lethal injection process. By next Wednesday, the state is to identify the manufacturer, seller, distributor, and supplier of the 3 drugs used in executions. That conflicts with a state law passed by the legislature this year, which allowed the Department of Correction to keep that information confidential. There have been some pharmaceutical companies who haven't wanted it to be known that they are a part of the execution process, because then they could be targets by opponents of the death penalty and just basically want to remain anonymous. Then on Tuesday, Judge Griffin denied a request by the state to lift a stay of execution, and he also turned down a request by the state for an expedited trial. Basically, the state said, we've got witnesses ready. We could have a trial right away on this. We have everything prepared and wanted to have this actually take place before the first execution is scheduled on Wednesday. But Judge Griffin turned that down. He also was critical, actually very much took aim at some of the things that the state argued during that hearing on Tuesday, saying that the state did not receive notice that a restraining order was being considered. And Judge Griffin actually made some pretty striking comments that the state's appeal was factually groundless, categorically false, as well as unwarranted. Chris, on Wednesday, you covered a media availability with Governor Hutchinson in which he responded to the back and forth going on between the attorneys representing the Attorney General's office and Judge Griffin.
Right. And by that time, the Attorney General's office had filed an appeal with the Supreme Court. And it was after a press conference with Governor Hutchinson, some reporters asked him about this kind of saga, this kind of back and forth between Pulaski County Judge Griffin and the state's attorneys. And here's what Hutchinson had to say.
I thought the judge's comments and approach was inappropriate. I am delighted that the Attorney General sought to appeal that to the Supreme Court very quickly. This is a decision that should be substantively discussed and ultimately decided by the Supreme Court. I'm a little bit confused whenever the substantive issue is whether the state under the law can restrict the release and have confidentiality on the supplier of the drugs that are involved. That's what the law is, and the issue before the court is whether that approach is constitutional and provides due process. Well, before there's ever any court proceedings on it, there's a directive that has to be disclosed. And so it's very confusing to me that there really was an opportunity to, we were told to release information that is confidential under the law before the opportunity to litigate the case.
And as the governor mentioned there, the Attorney General's office did opt to immediately after Tuesday's hearing, within 2 hours, did request that the Arkansas Supreme Court review the lower court's action. And worth noting that Judge Griffin even said that the Attorney General could be subject to sanctions for making the assertions that were made on Tuesday, said that the office violated rules for civil procedure.
Yeah, and back to what you were saying, this all goes back to a state law that was passed by the legislature this year that required the confidentiality of any of the sources for execution drugs. And that seems to conflict directly with a previous court settlement that was filed with death row inmates and the State Department of Correction before that law was passed, which stated that the state had to disclose any sources of execution drugs. So it obviously has to be cleared up by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and at this point, we haven't heard whether or not the state Supreme Court will take this up. But as we record this on Friday, the attorney for the death row inmates asked that this stay be kept in place. Judge Griffin had scheduled a hearing for next March, actually the trial to take place the 1st and 2nd of next March, and asked that the executions be held until this trial. Judge Griffin also requested his order be kept in place. But Sarah, you covered the hearing last week in which the arguments were made before Judge Griffin, where he actually made this ruling, the case, the hearing that led to this stay. What do you think, listening to these developments?
Well, Chris, as you were saying, the attorneys for the plaintiffs are arguing that that previous agreement between the state and inmates on death row promised that the state would release the information. The attorneys for the state are saying that that was a different set of inmates and that the law has changed and that it's not relevant anymore. So that's up in the air. It's one of the questions up in the air. Last week, the hearing I went to, Judge Griffin was considering the state's motion to dismiss the case. They said that the attorneys for the inmates claims that the secrecy could cause a cruel and unusual death by virtue of the fact that no one would know what substances were being used and wouldn't be able to monitor that, that it was unconstitutional. The state was saying this is baseless, it should be dismissed, and instead the judge ruled not only against that but to issue a stay on the executions to consider the warrants of that or the merits of that case, that there might be another way to proceed with executions. This is what the attorneys for the inmates were saying. What about firing squads, electrocution chairs? And part of the issue is that, which came up in Oklahoma recently, is that one of the drugs that the U.S. Supreme Court had said was okay to use, given that there weren't a better option, ended up being different than the drug that they used, or rather they used a different drug than they said they would. So attorneys for the inmates here in Arkansas are saying, Oklahoma has a similar secrecy law. Look what this will lead to. We won't know what they're doing, and it might change as the availability of drugs changes.
Yeah, and that execution over in Oklahoma, I think it was something like took 44 minutes, and the inmate apparently, there were clear signs he was in discomfort. And then that goes back to, is this cruel and unusual punishment? And yeah, the attorney for the death row inmates, Jeff Rosenzweig, arguing if we don't know what the drugs are, how can we be sure that this will be an effective execution?
I guess even since the Supreme Court ruling, in some executions, inmates have shown greater levels of pain than was expected at different points, especially in the initial phases of the three-drug injection process. And so that's raising questions about how painful this is, the mixture that the court approved.
And again, according to Judge Griffin's order, the Department of Correction is supposed to release the details about the drugs and identify that information by next Wednesday. But of course, there is court action that could happen to halt that. I don't know for sure if anything has happened directly to stop that from happening, though that, as I think the governor said, would conflict with the law passed by the legislature this year.
And while those drugs are secret and the state won't tell exactly what happened, the Associated Press has had a number of stories where they've concluded what certain drug manufacturers most likely are based on some redacted photographs, I believe, and several European companies have acted on those reports, specifically requesting that Arkansas not use their products, and the state has said that they can't even confirm that those are the right companies.
Yeah. I guess Claudia Lauer of the AP went to her dentist, among other clever methods, and compared drugs that he was using and determined what she thought that they were. So that information is potentially out there.
Well, we'll find out what happens, but certainly the state very adamant about carrying out these executions. But at this point, who can say for sure what will happen? But at this point, looking unlikely that they will, especially the one for next week. Well, Chris, we now have a search underway for the next Department of Human Services director. Well, he still is until, what, the first of next year? Mm-hmm. John Selig announced he is stepping down.
Right, last week. And the governor spoke this week about, you know, what he'd like to see in a new director. But John Selig, he's been in state government for almost 30 years. Last 10 years, he was director of DHS, and it's the largest agency in state government, and it's grown significantly in recent years, primarily because of the expansion of Medicaid in the state. He spoke on AETN's Arkansas Week about what he'd like to see in his successor.
I would advise my successor to kind of set aside or try to look past any ideological differences and really try to understand where people are coming from. By that I mean legislators, you know, other policymakers, providers. I have found that if you really get to understand people's positions, they often have even though you may disagree with them, they have a rational reason for having that position, and you can usually find common ground and make some progress. And I'd also advise, don't think that you're going to win every battle, that it is often incremental, but you can see, if I look back, you can see the progress.
Can hear there, he's referring to some divisive issues that or divisive policies that DHS has had to oversee, primarily the expansion of Medicaid, private option. There's also been some issues with youth services and the lack of foster beds in the state. And there were reports on, you know, how the Medicaid verification system in the state could be improved, and DHS has come under fire from a lot of conservative legislators about that, as well as from lots of advocates about for foster kids. And Selig spoke on the program about kind of the management of the agency and what he sees as a need for the strengthening of personnel and the coordination for personnel to address those sorts of issues.
We manage billions of dollars and serve over 1 million people a year, mostly through community-based organizations. But we've got to make sure we have the organizational structure, but also that we're able to retain good people. Because if you're going to manage $8 billion well, you got to have sharp people and have them stay around long enough to have the expertise.
Now, Governor Hutchinson, speaking at that after that press conference from earlier this week on Healthy Arkansas, which we'll get to in a moment, was asked also about his search for a new DHS director. And Hutchinson seemed to indicate that he was looking both towards the public sector as well as the private sector for potential candidates. And here's something of what he had to say about that.
We're looking outside the norm. So we're both looking at, you know, what would be somebody that is not expected to be in that arena, but has that. I know what we need. We've got to have somebody that can understand $200 million IT contracts, that can minimize the risk to the taxpayers, that can work with the legislatures, that can recruit the right talent for the different levels of DHS as well. So big shoes to fill, but sometimes we limit ourselves in government by saying we've got to have somebody who's had experience that arena government. When I went to head up the DEA, I never had experience in managing the DEA. When I went to Homeland Security, there'd never been anybody to manage Homeland Security before. But, you know, we had the right experience for that. And so that's a criteria that I want.
So you can kind of get a sense of Governor Hutchinson's governing philosophy. He obviously would like to see somebody with a fresh approach to managing the agency. He was also asked whether the state might consider using some private funds to fund the salary of a new DHS director. A reporter with Talk Business, Steve Bronner, asked particularly about this because the Arkansas Economic Development Commissioner, Mike Preston, received some funds from the AEDC Foundation, which is, has some private dollars to kind of supplement his salary along with public dollars. And Selig makes about $162,000 a year. And Governor Hutchinson said he was not opposed to considering that approach of using some private dollars as well as public dollars to potentially fund the salary of a new DHS director. But he said there would have to be some potential legislation considering that.
And the governor has said Director Selig did a great job. He's the longest serving person in that job ever under Republicans and Democrats. Mike Huckabee appointed him. There's been a lot of pat on the backs for Selig, saying even though he's leaving, he's done a great job. It's by his own choice. The governor will say, I even asked him to stay on till the end of the year, you know. But at the same time, Hutchinson pointed to something that a lot of maybe the most conservative quarter of legislators have been really hard on Selig about, those IT contracts. And the governor mentioned a $200 million IT contract, and that's something that is about two times over budget so far. So there's been a lot of problems, at least from the conservative spectrum of the Republican caucus, and they've been very hard on him lately, as before and after this announcement.
Of course, he also had that review of DHS, particularly the Division of Family Service, the foster care system, as you mentioned, Chris, that although the governor was laudatory about it, it sounded like a pretty critical review of his whole agency. I wonder, any thoughts about if there's anything behind the resignation?
Well, I guess it could be a lot of those forces that we've been mentioning about various scandals that have gone on. But Ernie Dumas on Arkansas Week from that same program said that DHS has always had scandals. If you look at an agency that big, there's going to be places where you can point to no matter how good the director is. But the Stevens Group report that came out late last month or earlier this month about the future of healthcare reform, at least how DHS is involved, they said, yeah, we have these problems, but it's really a problem about not giving DHS enough resources to have the capacity to manage contracts, to manage this huge agency. So their focus was kind of, if you want the agency to function better, you're going to have to fund it better and staff it better, which isn't a Selig problem.
Well, Chris, related to healthcare, this week the governor announced a plan for combating obesity in Arkansas. This comes not long after the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation ranked Arkansas as having the highest adult obesity rate of any state in the nation at 35.9%. 10 years earlier, that rate was at 24%. The state was then ranked as the eighth most obese for adults. So that seems to indicate a clear problem in Arkansas. You were at the governor's announcement. How are they going to combat this problem?
Well, it's interesting to note that you say 10 years ago we were ranked eighth. And at that time, under the Governor Mike Huckabee administration, there was a significant piece of anti-obesity legislation passed, Act 1220, which mandated the measuring of body mass indexes for school children and for kids as a means of combating childhood obesity. And we've had that data for the last 10 years, and it's kind of shown that childhood obesity hasn't gone up, but it hasn't gone down either. It's kind of stayed the same. Meanwhile, as you say, adult obesity rates have increased over that time. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of this initiative, what they call the Healthy Active Arkansas Plan, that the governor announced along with a whole coalition, or they call it a consortium of public health officials, both in the public and private sector. There are representatives from UAMS, Baptist Health, the Minority Health Commission, the Health Department, the Arkansas Surgeon General, all kind of collaborating with this sort of campaign to kind of reorient the state's approach after, 10 years down the line from this last anti-obesity campaign that was produced by the state. In short, it seems like a, they describe it as a framework. And here's Arkansas Surgeon General Greg Bledsoe kind of describing what the general scope of the program is.
The Healthy Active Arkansas Initiative is a project that really focuses on nine key things. Nine things that we hope will provide a framework going forward to help increase the healthiness in our state. So going through the list very quickly, the first of which is creating physical spaces that allow us to be connected but also encourage us to be active. Initiating nutritional standards for government institutions and the private sector, as well as nutritional standards for our schools. Encouraging physical education and activity in schools, as well as healthy work sites. And we'll be hearing about one work site that was able to initiate some of these measures. Improving access to healthy foods while also diminishing the consumption of sugary beverages, particularly among our young children, and encouraging breastfeeding for new mothers with young children, and in all, pulling all this together, having a marketing plan that is able to culturally, appropriately address these issues in the various diverse communities that we have around our state.
You heard a mention there, how we were going to hear from someone in the private sector. There was a some representative from Nabholz Construction saying that they instituted some health policies or health guidelines for their employees, you know, some anti-tobacco campaign among their employees, that, and along with some other things that significantly decreased their healthcare premiums for the insurance that they had to provide. So it was a cost-saving measure for that company, as well as it providing healthier outcomes for the employees. And that was kind of a model in which the state is trying to initiate this campaign. Some of the initial questions, at least from reporters, were like, well, what is this going to cost initially? And, what exactly is going to happen? I mean, it sounds like a marketing campaign. And the governor seemed adamant that any initial cost of the program would be covered by savings later to healthcare costs overall. They released some statistics like about 40% of all obesity attributable expenditures in Arkansas are financed by Medicare and Medicaid, you know, public programs, government funded healthcare. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, Medicaid is a large part, even though the state doesn't fund much of the Medicaid program. It's mostly on the federal level. The state will be eventually absorbing some of the cost, and this governor is looking for ways in which to reduce healthcare costs while providing healthier outcomes for citizens. So that's one way in which any costs would be diminished through this program, is by providing healthier outcomes. Healthcare costs themselves would go down because you'd see, less, hypertension or diabetes or, stroke in your people who are getting regular exercise or eating healthier.
Yeah. And the governor was adamant that this wasn't just a one-time press conference or a PSA, as he put it, that this is part of a long-term effort.
Right. And he was also asked, will this require some legislation in the next legislative session? And he seemed open to that idea that maybe some of the ideas submitted in this plan might require some legislation or some policy proposals that are more concrete in law. Now, at the press conference, there was an attendee, Willie McGee of the Stop the Violence Coalition, and he kind of made some comments to the governor afterwards. And he had sort of a criticism that in this plan, one of the things that isn't being considered is violence in public spaces. Now, last week on the program, we spoke about how former U.S. Representative Jay Dickey is calling for the reinstitution of public health research into gun violence across America from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And this kind of relates to that in that Willie McGee's from El Dorado. He's on the Minority Health Commission. But he was sort of critical in that homicide is noted by the CDC to be the leading cause of death for African-American males from 18 to 25. And his point was that, well, a lot of our neighborhoods, especially in minority communities, are not safe. So how can we exercise or do all these things when that's not being addressed? And here's some of his comments.
Shouldn't that be on the disease list, like diabetes, high blood pressure? I mean, that's an issue, man, just saying that your life is going to be cut short because somebody's going to murder you. But that's not on the person that get killed, but what do you think they do with the person that did the murder? We incarcerate them. We spend about $40,000 to $60,000 to incarcerate them. That bill never go away. Well, we could have put that same $60,000 in the neighborhood and maybe help these kids learn how to grow gardens or safe areas like playground areas or basketball areas or parks where they can feel safe, where they can play and exercise at.
So for the most part, people were, or the public health officials were pretty excited about this plan, but as you can tell, some had, you know, some reservations about it, let's say.
Yeah. Well, shifting to politics, Jacob, this week the Libertarian Party of Arkansas announced it's filing a federal lawsuit over a filing deadline for candidates to run in the 2016 election. And a lot of this stems from the legislature earlier this year moving the date for the primary next year. Typically, the primaries are in May next year. It's part of this so the state can participate in this so-called SEC primary for the presidential primary. That date is going to be in March, and as a result, the filing deadline has had to be moved.
Yeah, that also moved forward a couple months, so we'll have the filing deadline officially open in early November, and I believe close on November 9th is, I think, the date. And the Libertarian parties, their fundamental complaint is, you're asking us as a third party, you're asking parties to have some nominees finalized in November, yet the major parties won't even have their presidential nominees figured out until later on.
Right. And in fact, they're planning to hold a nominating convention next weekend, almost reluctantly on this. They're requesting additional time in this lawsuit, saying that it's not necessary to have everybody in place a year before the election date. I spoke with the Secretary of the Libertarian Party of Arkansas, William Brackeen, about the concerns.
The central issue is that they have moved the primary date up, which requires us now to have our nominating convention a full year ahead of the general election. And the central issue is that it's inherently unfair to require us to have our entire slate of candidates finalized before the other two parties have even started their process.
Yeah, and I imagine it gives also incumbents a bit of an advantage.
Yes, I've heard it referred to as incumbent insurance because it's so much more difficult for someone in the shortened period of time that they would have to do so to raise the money to run for office, to do the advertising to run for office, and to get the exposure necessary to unseat an incumbent.
Jacob, do you think this does give an advantage to the two big parties or incumbents?
I would think that the two parties, the Democrats and Republicans that enacted this law in the first place, probably wouldn't have passed it if they thought it would hurt them at the very least. But Nate Bell, who used to be in the Republican Party, now an independent from MENA, he, right after this bill was passed, he referred to it as the Incumbent Protection Act, and he switched parties in part because of this. He thought it was unfair, as the secretary for the Libertarian Party mentioned, not just to third parties, but to any incumbent anywhere. It's just, it's a long way out before the primary to have to make sure that you're filed, have resources together to make that kind of life-changing decision. Of course, it makes the campaign season a little bit longer, too.
And as I said, the Libertarian Party is asking for more time to allow candidates to file for office, but still going ahead and preparing just in case and having their nominating convention next weekend. This has been assigned to Judge James Moody, and the suit is asking that four sections of the state law be be found unconstitutional, but unclear at this point when that will be heard. Meanwhile, Jacob, we do have a couple of candidates who are launching their campaigns, one in particular this weekend.
Right. And at this point, it looks like the primaries for the major parties, at least at the top of the ballot, things like the Senate, congressional races, there's not going to be a lot of competition. Diane Curry for the 2nd Congressional District representing Central Arkansas in the U.S. House, that seat is currently held by Republican French Hill, who's in his first term. I spoke with her quite a bit, and also Connor Eldridge, a Democrat, is going to try to challenge John Bozeman for the U.S. Senate seat. And let's take a little bit of listen to Curry. She differed from Eldridge. In the past, Eldridge has tried to distance himself from the president that appointed him to his previous U.S. attorney's post. But Diane Curry, I asked her about President Obama and what she thought.
President Obama has done a tremendous job. He's done some great things while being in office. And in fact, the affordable health care is one that's good for all.
So Diane Curry, she didn't seem like she wanted to shy away from the president at all, which might be okay, at least in the second district. There are some counties, some cities in central Arkansas that support the president. However, I asked her a little bit about clean power, the idea of climate change. She seemed mildly supportive of the president's clean power plan.
Carbon change is a concern with our environment. I do like the initiative. Of course, I would be concerned with the replacement of people. Because, you know, you have a lot of people that work in those the minimum wage job area and some above. So we definitely want to take our time and really analyze what needs to happen with that. Of course, I look at the coal plant here in Arkansas, so it would definitely be an impact.
With that gradual approach in mind that you prefer, do you think global warming, though, or climate change is real and caused by man?
I think it's a combination of calls, not totally by man, but in that case, it goes back to businesses and maybe making sure that the guidelines are put in place that may not be there. So you definitely want to do everything that would help.
But Curry's main priority, and it makes sense with her background, she used to be on the Little Rock School District, is education funding. She said she likes parts of No Child Left Behind, the Bush era program, but thinks it needs to be funded more adequately and that it never has been at this point. She didn't give me a specific dollar amount of what she thinks a minimum wage should be, but she said she's interested in the concept of a living wage. I asked her specifically if she's okay with $15 an hour, which Hillary Clinton, I believe, supports, but I know Bernie Sanders does. She didn't quite say yes or no on that.
I heard Hillary Clinton said $12.
$12 an hour, okay. But there's a lot of issues with Diane Curry. She said she's just not quite certain about at this moment. She wasn't sure about assessing Russia's involvement in Syria and things like that, which are a little out of her wheelhouse for her normal professional life to this point, thinking about foreign policy type issues. But her campaign, not so organized like Connor Eldridge. Connor Eldridge has staff at this point. I don't think Diane Curry has much staff. And Eldridge announced that he's raised $400,000 in the first 3 weeks of his campaign. He's going to have a formal launch party this weekend.
Yeah, in Augusta, his hometown.
His hometown, yeah. And Eldridge, he's definitely more conservative than Diane Curry would be. He makes no bones about it. And Augusta, rural setting, north central Arkansas.
And Eldridge, former U.S. attorney. I saw a headline noting that Eldridge raised more money here in the past period than incumbent Senator John Bozeman. Of course, Eldridge has been out there telling people it's been clear for about a month now that he is going to run. So he's been out there, where Senator Bozeman probably hasn't even really started the re-election campaign process so much.
Last time I looked, earlier today at least, Bozeman hadn't announced his third quarter campaign report. And none of these results are available for the public to look through yet. We can't yet see where Eldridge got his money from, but they sent out a press release saying that's the total they're submitting to federal officials. So we could look at that later. But I think on hand, Bozeman has about $800,000, so in the first 6 months of the year. So it seems like they're about even. Eldridge obviously might have a little bit more of fresh enthusiasm, some Democratic donors who haven't been tapped in the past 4 to 6 years, where Bozeman's been continuously raising some amount of money.
Well, Sarah, this week we had an interesting statement that came out Tuesday evening from Education Commissioner Johnny Key, in that he said, and I'll read here, "It is apparent that we used language that left a misleading impression that Arkansas was backing away from high standards. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is concerning the park test. Give me a little background here, what he was responding to.
Well, last week, the State Department of Education released results from last year's park assessment. It was the first year the state had used it. It's tied to Common Core, and it was an electronic assessment except for districts that opted out. And the results seemed to be that about two-thirds of students had scored adequately on the test, which would be better than the state would typically do on the previous benchmark exams. Common Core and PARC are supposed to be more rigorous, and that's part of the reason that states around the country are adopting them nationwide to get sort of on the same playing field and set higher standards. So the state had made this announcement, and then Monday the Washington Post published a story saying that Arkansas and Ohio had inflated their scores by setting adequacy at a 3 out of 5 rather than a 4 out of 5, which is what PARC recommends and what all the other states are doing. And at that point, I guess the Department of Education realized that they had been unclear in the release from last week and issued an apology Tuesday evening. The Arkansas Times reports that the U.S. Department of Education was preparing a statement to say it was disappointed that Arkansas had made this choice to inflate its scores, what actually turns out to be closer to a one-third or 40% proficiency rate is what the state's actually experiencing. So instead of getting that kind of publicity, I guess the Department of Education, knowing this, came out and clarified actually the adequacy level is a 4 for Arkansas, and in fact that release was misleading. And then meanwhile, a select group of teachers from around the state have been talking about Common Core standards in literacy and math, and they are reviewing Common Core for an Arkansas-specific set of standards. The state regularly reviews its educational standards, but this is something that the governor's task force on Common Core asked for with its recommendations. So I spoke with Stacey Smith from the Department of Education, and she explained why there's a need for adequacy standards to be uniform around the nation and why Arkansas is joining Common Core to match other states.
When Common Core came along, but you know, all 50 states had their own set of third grade standards. All right, so the third grade teacher in Texas has something different than Arkansas. So when Common Core came about, it was really, you know, governors coming together saying, why aren't we doing the same thing? Why aren't we expecting students in Massachusetts to know the same thing as students over here in Florida or in Arkansas? And when they compared these state frameworks to each other, some states, you know, they weren't expecting their students to be on a certain reading level, where in this state, you were expected to be at a higher reading level. And so what makes the student in this state smarter than the students over here? Well, it's what we're teaching in the classroom.
And I asked, with Common Core, you hear a lot about this depth and analysis, comprehension. And I asked Ms. Smith, what does that mean? And she said, Common Core is about expecting all students to learn to think.
Yeah, it's the whole idea of being able to problem solve and think and being able to know where to go look for the answers, not just be told, you know, what the answer is. You know, even the field of science right now and the technologies that we're going for, you know, what we used to do, you know, what you used to be able to graduate from high school knowing isn't enough all the time. I mean, most careers right now require some type of post-secondary training.
So what the department's doing, they've posted a survey on their website and they've gotten nearly 2,000 responses from teachers and parents about Common Core. And these teachers who've been chosen from districts around the state are going through and voting on the standards. It sounds like they've just started, but so far it sounds like there might be a slight divergence in the math area from what Common Core is recommending. Sounds like there's some consensus that a compromise between the Common Core's focus on comprehension and understanding what's behind math and math ideas might need to be balanced out a little bit with some more formulas and some more memorization, which is what we might call the old school approach. And so I spoke with Bonnie Baggett, who is a math specialist from the Bentonville Public Schools, who's been a part of those conversations.
We have been talking about what procedural fluency looks like, and part of the definition that we're putting with that is being able to be flexible in your thinking and being able to, yes, know the rules and know the procedures, but also having the understanding behind the rules and procedures to be able to shift those or alter those a little bit if the context determines that, you know, maybe this set of rules doesn't work for a particular problem.
Is that what Common Core already asked for?
It is what Common Core was asking for, but I think we're striving to hit a balance here. I think Common Core went very much to the conceptual understanding, and that we're striving for a little bit more of a balance, recognizing that there is a need for procedures and there is a need for rules in math, but that has to be backed up by conceptual understanding. So we're trying to hit that balance.
So I asked the teachers and I asked Ms. Smith if they're concerned about the PARC scores being much lower than we had thought last week, and about Common Core and the ACT Aspire new test, which has been used in Alabama but not met elsewhere, and the ACT, which the state already uses. And they said they haven't gotten details on what's going to be in that test, but Stacey Smith was saying every year the state starts a new test, scores are lower than they normally would be because there's this adjustment. And that was partly why she attributed what she attributed to the low scores on the PARC test this year.
And the recommendations from the teachers, how will they work with the recommendations from the task force appointed by the governor in determining what Arkansas standards eventually become?
Well, the task force recommended to keep Common Core by name and let the teachers work out standards that they approve of along with the input from Arkansans through this survey. Then on the district level, teachers and administrators will choose curriculum to meet those standards. So it's really the next level down of decision making from the task force choice to stick with Common Core.
I guess I have a question about the task force results. To me, I guess I'll have to look back, but it seems a little bit murkier than that. I remember afterward, Tim Griffin, the lieutenant governor who chaired that task force, he was saying, well, this gives us license to, in the future, when we set our standards in the regular standards process, we won't have to worry about that whether or not we're tethered to Common Core. We'll set the standards with what we think is best for Arkansas, and if we continue to be in Common Core, then so be it. If not, that's fine, too. But at this, your impression is that everyone is pretty much working with the idea of Common Core.
I heard a lot about Common Core. All the teachers I spoke to, this might have been coincidental, but they all seem to be largely in favor of Common Core. I think this question about maybe taking a hybrid approach with math is an area where the state might move slightly away from how other states have interpreted Common Core.
And Common Core is flexible enough to allow all sorts of different adjustments.
My understanding is Common Core is a set of standards that could be revised on the state level, and that's what's happening.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up this week's podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
Chris Hickey was also with us this week. He also is the composer of our theme song. Thanks for listening. If you're not already a subscriber, do go to iTunes. We hope you will, so that you can automatically get the podcast each week and get our insight into the daily news. This week's episode is produced by me. I'm Michael Hiplin, KUAR. It's an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I should mention next week is KUAR's fall fundraiser. And if you're a listener of public radio, if you appreciate the local coverage we bring, especially getting out in the field, covering stories, bringing you the important stories that are happening in the state, I hope you'll show your support. And if you're not already, become a donor to KUAR. If you are a donor but not a regular supporter, hope you'll become a sustaining member. You can call during business hours next week, 501-569-8485, or give online at KUAR.org.
Well, Michael, it sounds like you're ready for Pledge Week.
I have been hitting on the high points. You know, public radio, I mean, it's a funny thing when we do come around to pledge drives, but it really is only through the support. We quite honestly are the only radio station that gets out and covers stories in the field. So you really do get something here that you can't get anywhere else here in Central Arkansas This is KUAR.